From the table to the chef's kitchen, we're exploring the food culture of France right now on Travel with Rick Steves with Adam Gopnik. Adam's been writing fiction, reviews, humor pieces, and art and social critiques for The New Yorker now for more than 25 years. His books include a collection of essays about raising his children in New York City, about taking his family to live in Paris, a book comparing the lives of Lincoln and Darwin, who shared the same birthday, and children's and juvenile fiction. His latest book is The Table Comes First: Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. It's published by Knopf. Just thinking about how the chef is a part of the conversation and the theater of the meal, it just all makes sense to me, because to have some kind of a connection with the chef makes it a much more intimate experience. And I find all over my travels, chefs just love to come out when they're done cooking and just kind of check in with you and celebrate what a beautiful time it was for everybody involved.
When my son was about 18 months, we went for a very special lunch at a three-star place in the north of France in Champagne. And the chef had made for him, invisibly, you know, now you didn't see him, these wonderful scrambled eggs, which is still the scrambled eggs I make for him to this day. And when the chef came out, just as you described, just sort of make the rounds of the table and see if everyone was pleased, my 18-month-old son rose up in his high chair and gave him a standing ovation.
Whoa. Now that's a triumph, Dad. That's great.
Exactly. And I watched it. I say to the chef, how did you make those eggs? And he gave me the recipe, and I include it in The Table Comes First.
I'm talking with Adam Gopnik, his book, The Table Comes First. Our phone number is 877-333-7425. Abby's on the phone in Tallahassee, Florida. Abby, thanks for the call.
I can't wait to read your book, Adam. It sounds really interesting. I lived in France for a while as an au pair. It was more than getting to visit. I lived with a family, and it's changed my lifestyle back in the States and how I eat. And
can you say in what way?
I eat a lot slower now. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd have three-hour meals on a weeknight in France. Learn to, like, slow down, enjoy things more.
Abby, did you find that the French would eat more with the season?
Very much so. They did not buy things out of season, and they learned to... That's a big thing that I learned there, was eating in season. You know, we'd go out on the weekends and go mushroom hunting and eat those in omelets for dinner. They had a garden, and in the summer, you know, we ate a lot of tomatoes, and we wouldn't eat tomatoes and... the winter.
Unless it was tomato season, yes.
Why would they eat with the season then?
Because that's when things were at their peak and that's when they tasted the best. It also, you know, just kind of goes with the weather.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't want to idealize the French too much, because there's plenty of frozen peas served in French meals. And there's, unfortunately, now more and more you can find things like strawberries out of season. But the principle, the things taste best when they're freshest, is one that I think still is at the heart of the French attitude to food.
Yes, definitely. Even though we would sometimes do grocery shopping at a chain supermarket, they would have, you know, like eggs from a local farmer in the chain supermarket. And they seem to just, you know, whereas here there's like a whole movement for local food, it seemed to just be like a normal thing there.
That's right. You're always told, or there's always a little sign saying where the beef comes from, where the lamb was raised, and so
right.
on. As you say, you see more and more of that here, but it's taken for granted over there.
Yes, it definitely is, and it's hard to come back here and, you know, they're like, oh, you know, go in the grocery store and be like, well, I don't know where this came from, so I don't want to eat it.
Abby, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Enjoy your French eating habits back in the United States.
Thank you. Good talking with you guys.
Yeah. And Lynn's on the phone in Coral Springs, Florida. Lynn, thanks for your call.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. I'm working at my appetite.
Hi,
you're talking with Adam.
Well, I did read one of his articles, and I'll never forget how he said his son did not like the American yogurt. It was too sugary. Am I recalling this correctly?
Yes, that's right. One of the things that was startling to him as a little boy who had grown up in France and then came to America when he was seven is the incidental sugar in American food. You know, it's always sort of startling how much sugar we put into condiments, into ketchups and mustards and yogurts and everything. We sort of start with a kind of default base of sugar and then work around it. And sugar in Europe and in France particularly is ever present. You know, you have that great dessert cuisine, but it's more specifically used almost as a kind of spice rather than as the concrete foundation for all eating.
That really stuck with me when I read that article. It stuck with me for years. What I was going to also say is that I'm a flight attendant for American Airlines, and I am lucky enough to eat in Europe once a week. And it has really influenced my palate. I have also seen how France has changed throughout the years from when I was a student there in 1970, not a student there, when I went over to travel.
When you were a student, right, and traveling.
Yes, to the way it is right now, and stores like Picard, which has frozen food, very interesting to walk through. But it certainly has changed. I still am shocked when I see diet sodas, because when I went to school in Italy and I would ask for something like that, they looked at me like I was crazy, including when they saw me put, at the time, saccharin into my coffee. They just were
scandalized.
Thought
it was nuts, right? Then they have a whole little cult of it, Coca Light and so on. Yeah, I think that's true.
Yes.
I'm so glad you get to enjoy eating well in exchange for putting up with all of us miserable, cranky passengers. That cheers me endlessly.
That is another story. That is for another program. And yes, we do talk about you, but go on.
Linda, are you saying then basically the change you've seen in French eating habits is they're becoming what we would think is just more American with fast food and
yes,
diet?
Yes. I mean, I've been flying Europe for 20 years, and right. I still get surprised when I see McDonald's that have been there for years. But I just am imprinted from so many years ago the way it was. And I'm scandalized.
Well, you know, Rick, if I may say, I share our caller's dismay when I see, you know, McDonald's in France and all of that. But let's remember, it's French people who are eating there. And the reason they're eating there is the same reason that Americans eat there or any other fast food place. It's because they promise cheap, somewhat nutritious, whether we entirely buy it or not, food that's quickly available. So the appeal of fast food around the world isn't just the appeal of sort of junk and bad taste. It's also the appeal in a time when we're all so pressed for time, a time when we're all so pressed for money. Those things have a natural appeal. And the real challenge, I think, for the next century, or at least for our generation, is to find ways that you can reconcile our need for speed with our appetite for excellence.
That's a good challenge for French and American eaters. Lynn, thanks for your
Equally
call.
Equally so.
You're welcome.
Bye now. Happy
Bye-bye.
Eating. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Adam Gopnik, and Adam's new book is The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Adam, when we're talking with people who are, you know, having a chance to go to France and go to Europe and be exposed to this more ritualistic kind of eating and to enjoy the luxury of having a slow meal and so on, do you find in your travels that enjoying and appreciating fine food is a class thing? High-class people are able to appreciate it more?
Well, rich people can buy more fancy food than the rest of us, can't they? That's sort of, it stands to reason. Good food is another story. There's fancy food and then there's good food. I think that, though, you have to search more now, in Europe at least, in France even, for good food than maybe you did 25 or 30 years ago, where you could find a great 15 franc, you know, kind of $5 menu all over the place. I still think it's there. And I certainly don't think that anybody who's traveling on a budget has to rule out the possibility of eating wonderfully well. I think it's a question of knowing where you want to go, knowing the kinds of things you like. Obvious things, Rick, like being willing to try things that you don't normally eat at home. I would rather eat a, you know, jarret de porc, a pig's foot with lentils, in France than try and have another steak. And the same thing you can multiply right throughout. The taste for the odd bits of the animal. You know, the book is called The Table Comes First because a wonderful cook in London named Fergus Henderson said to me once that he doesn't understand why a young family starting out would buy a sofa or a television or even a bed. Don't they know the table comes first? And his whole theory of eating is that you can only eat meat if you're prepared to eat the whole beast. That is, if you're prepared to eat the snout and the ears and the tail and the hooves, then you can eat the fillet. And I think that the more you focus on that kind of, what should we call it, encyclopedic eating, the more pleasure you'll have and the better food you'll get at a reasonable price.
You know, that was one of the most fascinating parts of your book. It seems like the subtitle would be Nose to Tail Eating.
Mm-hmm.
You quoted Fergus Henderson, this British chef, as writing this: "The absurdity of our meat eating is limiting it to a few square feet of muscle near the skeleton."
Exactly. That's Ferguson. He's a wonderful man. And that's his theory of food. And what's so interesting about it, Rick, is we know a lot of ethical vegetarians, but that's a way of being an ethical carnivore, of saying, I'm not just going to eat whatever I find wrapped in plastic at the supermarket. Mm. I'll eat meat, but I'll only eat it in a responsible way that does some kind of honor to the animal that I've killed.
I can taste it now. Deep fried tripe, veal tail broth, deviled kidneys, ox heart with beetroot.
The ox heart with beetroot, I will testify, is a fabulous thing. And that ox heart is delicious as well. But those are the kinds of vistas, if you like, the kind of new frontiers of eating that are very alien to most Americans, but that I think that they'd be surprised how much they would enjoy it.
Oh, and that's part of getting out of your comfort zone when you're traveling. When you go to those markets, remember, there's some very salt-of-the-earth little eateries nearby where they might specialize in head-to-tail dining, huh?
One of the funny things I always find going to a market in Europe, Rick, is that one thing that has not been globalized in our time are fish. You always see a weird-looking kind of fish at any market you go to, whether you're in Venice or in the south of Italy or in France. There's some weird little whiskered swimmer that you haven't seen before. And I always like to try and get one or two of those, but I have to sneak them by my 12-year-old daughter. 12-year-old girls believe that food should look like the food they know.
I had the most frustrating time as a tour guide with a bunch of high school kids once in Italy. And we got served these beautiful fish, you know, with the heads on them.
Right.
And the girls just freaked out and they wouldn't touch it. And I just thought, what a shame.
12-year-old girls have limitless virtues, but pioneering and eating is not one of them.
Well, that's getting out of their comfort zone again. Also, you talk in a fascinating way about vegetarianism and making the case against eating meat and making the case for eating meat. How does vegetarianism set with French chefs and so on?
Well, for the first time, there's a 3-star cuisine végétale, vegetarian restaurant in Paris. I profile in the book the chef, Alain Passard, who runs it. He had a conversion experience. I actually worked in his kitchen for a little while. He used to be, you know, full-on roasts and great French meat, and now he just does vegetables from his own garden, some of them extremely simple and very expensive, sliced tomatoes with fleur de sel. So for the first time, you have a cuisine végétale.
As opposed to vegetarian cooking.
Yes, it's a very important point for Alain Passard, because vegetarian cooking is still associated in France with sort of depressed ethical guys who live in health food stores. The idea of a cuisine végétale is that it's deliberate choice. It's joyful to eat vegetables because they can be more varied and delicious. One of the things that Passard does, it's almost hilarious, is you know how you always get something baked in a salt crust duck or something? Well, he does a giant beet of his own baked in a salt crust, and it's served to you just the way a shank of veal might be served, but it's just that wonderful single beet. And it's pretty fabulous.
You know, that is so important to recognize that there is, what did you call it, cuisine végétale, as opposed to vegetarian cooking. You go around Europe and you find a vegetarian restaurant. Usually it's just, as you said, it's for people that are determined to be healthy, not enjoy the meal as much, but to be healthy.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm Rick Steves. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're speaking with Adam Gopnik. His new book, The Table Comes First, Family, France, and the Meaning of Food. Adam, I love the chapter in your book about wine, and you wrote, the wine expert can create a new space between intoxication and discrimination and then perform in it, just as the fun of being a connoisseur of the classical nude, a la Rubens and Titian, is to play in the space between the erotic and the pornographic.
Well, don't you think it's true, though, if you talk to wine, what we call in our family, after my daughter, connoisseurs. She saw word once.
Connoisseurs, and said, right.
Connoisseurs. Dad, what's a wine connoisseur? That those connoisseurs never like to recognize that the primary function of wine is to get people drunk. That's why we have it. That's why it exists. Now, that doesn't exhaust all of its ritual purposes and all the way we use it, but they like to create this space, as I say, where intoxication is this kind of secret that you don't talk about much, and appreciation, discrimination, what year, what terroir, what vintage, is it Burgundy or Bordeaux, that's all that matters. But secretly inside, we all know that while those things matter, wine exists to make us happy by getting us drunk. And it is just like sex, right? We perform sex, we enjoy sex, we delight in sex, and yet someplace deep inside us, we know that the reason human beings are drawn to sex is because we are reproduction machines. That's what our genes want us to do. That doesn't mean we have to make kids when we make love. It just means that that's the underlying reality of it.
It's so true. People don't talk about the buzz they get from the wine, but that's...
It's inseparable from the experience. And anybody who denies that a significant, huge part of the pleasure of wine is the intoxication it provides, not over-intoxication, and certainly not alcoholism, but the pleasure that the glass of wine gives you at the end of the day, no matter where it comes from, no matter how perfectly articulated your appreciation of its dried berries and wild smoke and total 1986-ness is the pleasure of the universal intoxicant of alcohol.
And then you can take it also to the ritual. I mean, because a lot of times it just seems over the top, but the ritual, I mean, you wrote, the wine talk and wine ceremony are not simply snobbish distractions that lead us away from the real experience. They're part of what lets the experience happen.
Well, sure. You know, I think that's always true. If you think about it, if we just were drinking wine out of unlabeled jugs without any idea of what it was, we wouldn't have that full experience. It is the experience of the pour, of the label, of the context. You know, all of our experiences in life depend on context. That's what gives us our pleasures.
It's like dressing up to go to a play.
Exactly, exactly. Putting on that tie is part of what makes the opera sing.
Adam Gopnik, author of The Table Comes First, Family France and the Meaning of Food. You know, your book is a celebration of food and making it theater and making it ritual and making it convivial. I was wondering, when you look at all of this, this occasionally pretentious and over-the-top appreciation of food, are you looking at it? Is it a satire, and are people taking food too seriously? Or I wasn't quite sure what the backstory of your book was.
I think that we run the risk of taking food too pompously, maybe. I don't think we can take things too seriously. I don't think we can take our pleasures too seriously. If you believe in the value of pleasures, if you believe that living a life of pleasure is an important thing, then you can't take it too seriously. What you've got are all of these material appetites, appetites in lots of ways, we share with animals, and we try to elevate them and dignify them by thinking about them. An animal that eats and thinks has to think about what it eats in order not just to be an animal. I say that somewhere, and I think it's true. I don't think we can think too hard about our pleasures. I think that we can think too abstractly about our pleasures. I think that if we lose sight of, or we lose tongue of, taste of, the simple delight of the food in front of us, and we lose it in worrying too much about either the origin of the zucchini on the one hand or the year of the Bordeaux on the other hand, then I think we allow that wonderful sense of shared pleasure to sort of dissipate into the abstractions of food snobbery. I would never want to do that, but I think that in everything we do, you know how it is, Rick, the more you know about the place you're going to travel to, the more deeply you enjoy it. There's a big difference between knowing something and being a snob about it. I'm all for knowledge. Mm-hmm. I'm all against snobbery.
So eating with joy and appreciation, clearly a life skill worth developing. And Adam, I would say your book, The Table Comes First, is a beautiful manual to read if that's your goal. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. Pleasure sharing a virtual table with you today.
All right.
À la prochaine.
You'll find more about French appetites and Adam Gopnik in the radio section of ricksteves.com. Our next culinary stop is Portugal. We're at 877-333-RICK.